From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made last week when a former United States Secretary of Defense made a public statement of his voting intentions. Mark Esper is a lifelong Republican who served as U.S. Secretary of Defense under President Donald Trump. Esper said he was disturbed by how Trump, in his view, abused the power of the presidency. And so Esper is making a departure. He will not vote for the Republican for president for the first time in his adult life. But Esper added he's not sure he's going to vote for Vice President Kamala Harris. He appreciates some aspects of Harris's campaign, but Esper says he still wants to see her move toward the center on policy issues. This prompted another longtime Republican, Tom Nichols, to incredulously mock Esper. Nichols wrote, mimicking Esper, that sure, Donald Trump is a danger to the Democratic order and doesn't understand the Constitution, but before voting for his opponent, he needs to learn more about her position on the carried interest tax loophole. In other words, Nichols can't believe that anyone is undecided at this point. But journalist Ron Brownstein takes a different view of undecided voters. He writes this week, quote, "When most people think about a voter still trying to make up their mind, they probably imagine a person who is highly likely to vote, but uncertain whether to support Harris, Trump, or a third-party candidate. Both political parties, however, are more focused on a different and much larger group of undecideds, potential voters who are highly likely to support Harris or Trump, but unsure if they will vote at all," end quote. To Brownstein, this is the real story of undecided Americans, those who don't know if they will vote in this cycle. And that group of Americans numbers in the many millions. We regularly turn to the expertise of Joseph Burgess to help us understand data and polling, and you can understand why often we focus on presidential numbers. Today, we are mostly looking elsewhere. Undecided voters have a great deal of influence over the balance of power in the United States Senate, for example, with competitive races happening in Ohio and Montana and Pennsylvania and Michigan and maybe even Texas, for starters. There are high-profile gubernatorial campaigns. Former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo's close associates are saying he wants to run for mayor of New York City, with Mayor Eric Adams facing increasing calls to resign. We have plenty to discuss there. Our guest is Joseph Burgess, team leader at the Social Sciences Data Lab at the University of Copenhagen. Joseph, welcome back to the program.
Evan, thanks so much for having me on. I don't even know what to say. We have so much to get through. It feels like every week there's some massive scandal that would take a whole hour to cover, but we'll try and get through it all, right?
Well, absolutely. And let me once again let our listeners know you are listening to a program that we are aided by not only technology, but a great WXXI team. I'm hosting this program from another state today. Joseph is, of course, on another continent. So, we're doing our best today. And if there's a little bit of a delay in the conversation, shouldn't be too much. And thank you for hanging in there with that. Listeners, if you've got comments, questions on polling data, how to become smarter consumers of data, you know how to find us. Connections at WXXI.org is a great start. And let me start, Joseph, with this. Do you agree with Brownstein that the bigger story on undecided voters in this election is the block of voters who are undecided on whether they will vote at all?
Absolutely. So it's the voters who are undecided on whether they will vote at all. But I wouldn't even, I would slightly adjust that framing. It's because it's not the way that they would think of it necessarily. It's that they still probably are not even thinking about the presidential election the way you or I or perhaps people with a deep interest in politics are. They're not fully tuned in yet. So some of them are, of course, maybe undecided, have thought about it, and they're like, I'm not sure whether I'll vote. Some of them really aren't thinking about this election at all yet, and maybe they're starting to tune in now as we get to the end of September and as ballots start to be cast. But these, I think it's helpful to emphasize with a kind of a different mindset. If you're a political junkie, you have to realize that a lot of people are just not as engaged with politics. Of course, many millions of people don't vote, and many do and just aren't that interested. And of course, their votes count the same, you know?
Well, we're not going to spend the hour on the presidential race. I just want to get a couple of things out of the way first, though, and ask you about the way that polling produces anxiety on an almost daily basis this late in the campaign. At the Democratic National Convention, Michelle Obama urged the crowd not to get deflated by a bad poll here and there. And this week, Vice President Harris has seen good polls from the so-called blue wall states, good national polls, but bad Sunbelt state polls. How much time should voters spend freaking out over individual polls, and how can they get a good handle on the bigger picture?
They should spend zero amount of time freaking out about the individual polls. So I guess we could end the episode right there, but we won't. I don't think it's healthy to kind of spiral in that way. And, you know, I do this because I enjoy it. I enjoy thinking about polling and demographics and people and how they're represented. But I think if that's causing you a lot of anxiety, I think you have to take some agency over your own life. And whether that's choosing to participate in the political process by, you know, go vote. Once voting is available to you, volunteer, talk to your friends and family. But I think there is a tendency for people to get in kind of like this doom loop of anxiety where you freak out about the polls. And of course, politics is very important to me, too. But I don't think that's a healthy way to live your life, I suppose. And that almost gets from the political to the pop psychology, right? Like you're Oprah and I'm Dr. Phil or something. But I don't think it's a healthy way, I guess, to consider the politics of everything. So I guess that's my take if we do want to play pop psychology.
I appreciate that. Well, this week, Nebraska Republicans rebuffed Donald Trump's urgings. They decided not to change how they allocate electoral votes. That means that even though Donald Trump will almost certainly win the state of Nebraska, Kamala Harris can pick up an electoral vote in an individual Nebraska district, and it could matter. If Harris wins Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, but loses the other four swing states, that one electoral vote in Nebraska would determine the election, moving from a 269-269 tie to a two-vote margin for Harris. Joseph, am I fixating on unlikely scenarios here, or do you agree that the Nebraska decision is a big story?
It's absolutely a big story. And full disclosure, I did live in Omaha, Nebraska at one point, and I volunteered for, and I think I may even have been briefly paid to actually work for one of the state senators who ended up voting on that decision. So I want to make sure to disclose that. Yeah, so, right, a real connection here. And you're in Ohio, so we're really connecting all the key states on the map, right? So it's all coming together. So I do think it's critical, and that's also one of the key House races, is that same electoral district focused around Omaha and some of the suburbs. So it's key to, I think, one of the most likely maps for Kamala Harris to win. It has a very competitive congressional race. And as we may get into when we talk about the Senate very soon, there's actually a race that Dems are a little bit thinking for the Senate there, that they could potentially pick up a federal Senate seat.
Well, in the U.S. Senate, so first of all, disabuse me my way of thinking in recent weeks has been wrong here. But the way I've been thinking about the Senate is that the seats that are vulnerable almost exclusively are held by Democrats. And so Democrats have to hold on to those seats if they want to, you know, have this 50-50 plus the VP situation, whereas Republicans are trying to pick off one or more and swing the balance of power. You know, but then I read about the polls in Texas, or you know, social media wants me to believe that it's a closer race than you think in Florida or maybe other places. Am I thinking about this the wrong way, that really the almost exclusively the vulnerable seats are just held by Democrats?
I would say that's if you just spent a couple minutes on it and you just had that first impulse, you'd be 99% correct, right? So I think Dems are starting to look at some potential reach seats. Like, what if Kamala Harris has a really good night, or potentially what if there's some late-breaking scandal or opportunity in Florida or Texas, or this very, very unlikely, but this independent candidate I was sort of hinting at in Nebraska. So they are sort of starting to look at that. But the reason they're starting to even think about that is because the map for them is so, so bad. So they are defending these deep, deep red states. So West Virginia, Montana, Ohio. Ohio, of course, was the classic swing state for much of my life and for most listeners, their lives as well. But now it's, of course, a state that Trump is likely to win by somewhere, 8 to 12 points. So they have to defend not only these deep red states, but also a number of swing states as well. So it's a very, very bad political cycle for them in the Senate. They're faced with a number of challenges. At the same time, in especially these swing states, they're actually performing quite well. So I think it's kind of a weird cycle where I think they're doing a very good job in races where they could be competitive. But I do think it's very likely at this point that they will lose seats just because of how red and Republican these areas are. West Virginia, for example, it's almost a 100% certainty that they will lose the Senate seat they currently hold there. So it's a difficult cycle for them in the Senate at the same time that they're looking to potentially flip back the House.
So let me, on the subject of the Senate, I want to ask sort of a broader based question, and then we can talk a little bit more specifically about individual races. But one observation that I have that might be wrong, and I'm often wrong, is that, in the recent Trump era, most of the last decade, we have seen not only Donald Trump at the top of the presidential ticket for Republicans, but an increasing number of Trump-endorsed and Trump-aligned candidates for governor, for Senate, for Congress. And a good example of that seems to be Arizona, where Carrie Lake, who is one of the chief purveyors of election lies and untrue information, and she is running against Ruben Gallego, and he is a Democrat, a veteran. Carrie Lake didn't have to be the Republican nominee. There was a Republican sheriff from one of the border counties who, he has been at times critical, more critical of Trump. He's not quite as aligned as Carrie Lake is. He challenged Carrie Lake, and the Trump machine beat him back, and he lost. Most of the polling indicated that he would have done better in the Senate race against Ruben Gallego, but now you got Carrie Lake on the ticket there. And it just seems to me, Joseph, that that the Republicans have not served themselves well by just deferring to Trump and his acolytes on who gets to be in these races, because you end up with the Mark Robinsons, the Carrie Lakes, and not in every race, but in a lot of races. And I think they're losing races that they don't have to lose necessarily on paper. What do you think?
This is kind of not the central question even of the 2024 election, but to me, maybe the central question of like the next 20 years. And it's so fascinating to me. What does Trumpism or MAGA or whatever you want to call it look like without Trump? And what we see so far is that a lot of candidates who are kind of philosophically aligned with Trump, endorsed by Trump, in any way kind of trying to be Trump, often underperform him, so that, when Trump first ran in 2016, he was thought of potentially as a weak candidate. In retrospect, we're seeing him actually as maybe an especially strong candidate for his philosophy, that many of these candidates who think like him, act like him, endorse a number of the same philosophies and laws as him, actually are not as well received by the electorate. So, for example, let's even look at J.D. Vance, his vice presidential nominee, who is in many ways aligned with Trump, right? Even picked by Trump to be his vice president. His overall polling is terrible. It's much worse than Trump's. And we see that kind of again and again, especially in 2022. but in 2024 as well, with the candidates you mentioned, that voters are not as inclined to support a candidate like Trump, who is not Trump, right? That these candidates actually are systematically underperforming. And we know that it's not all Republicans, and that we've seen Republicans who are kind of willing to break with Trump also do quite well. So the Republican governor of Virginia, for example, who has very high approval ratings, or the Republican governor of Vermont. So that these types of candidates are Republican in many ways, but they're overperforming Trump, while these kind of MAGA candidates who are not Trump underperform. And it's just a fascinating pattern.
Yeah, I'm trying to find an outlier or a counterexample, and it may be Maryland. So in Maryland, you have a state that was, Joe Biden won it by 33 points in 2020 in the state of Maryland. But this is a race that has become more competitive in the U.S. Senate because you have a longtime Democrat, Ben Cardin, who is retiring there. And the Democrats nominated Angela Alsobrooks, who is a county executive. She's a former state attorney. The Republicans nominated Larry Hogan, who is the former governor of Maryland. He was floated as a possible never-Trump Republican presidential candidate, sort of in the mode of Chris Christie. Although I don't know if Chris Christie considers himself never Trump, he's kind of in that category. Hogan is, sort of one of the rare Republicans who has not gone full Trump or has really been opposed to Trump in many ways. And so a lot of Democrats kind of like him for that. They don't maybe know much about him, but they appreciate that he has not gone fully into the Trump camp. And so the margin in those polls is a lot closer. I haven't seen anything that indicates that Hogan is likely to win, but what is that race? What's the story in that race to you?
You know, I think it teaches us something not just about that race, but about kind of the races that mirror it on the Democratic side. So a deep blue state like Maryland with a popular Republican like Hogan, and then these deep red states like Montana and Ohio that have popular Democratic incumbents. And I think that it's kind of the same story in both, at least to me, a kind of story of political gravity where these candidates are very strong. Hogan is almost certainly going to massively outrun Trump and put up a very respectable performance. But at the same time, they're running in these states that are overwhelmingly supportive of one party or the other. And I think it's very difficult at a certain point to kind of outrun that political gravity, to be able to outperform to that extent in a time when states are aligning their Senate and House votes more and more with their presidential vote. And I think it's just, I've always been very, very skeptical of Hogan's, the Republican's ability to win a federal race in Maryland. Some recent polling kind of vindicated me, showing also Brooks up massively, I think by 10 points or something. So I really have been pretty skeptical of it for that reason, that I think, if he was running in maybe a swing state, I think he would do very well. It's just difficult to imagine a Republican winning. And we've seen this type of story again and again. The Republican governor of Hawaii a few years back, running for Senate, I believe. And then, for example, you know, the Montana Democratic governor running for Senate, I think that was 2020. So it's a story we see again and again, where you may have these popular, especially governors of the opposite party, trying to kind of outrun a strong partisan trend. And it looks possible, but at the end of the day, I think it's good to be very skeptical of that.
You know, Joseph, I'm thinking about New York State, and let me pose this question to you in this context here. So in New York State, Governor Kathy Hochul beat Lee Zeldin, the Republican, by something like 5 points. I mean, producer Megan Mack is going to fact check me on the exact number, but it was around, I mean, I'm certain it wasn't double digits. And this is a state that is not a 5-point presidential state. It's not a 5-point voter registration state. So it ended up a lot closer than a lot of the built-in advantages for a Democrat would have you expect the result to be. If Larry Hogan gets within 5 points, if he doesn't win, but he loses by five, he loses by six, in a state that 4 years ago was Biden plus 33 for the Democrat, my guess is a lot of people would view that and say, boy, Larry Hogan is actually, he appeals a lot to the middle, that he's pretty popular, that he's got crossover appeal, that he overperforms a lot of his party. Whereas I don't think people are saying that about Lee Zeldin. I think they're saying it shows sort of the unpopularity of Kathy Hochul. Am I reading that wrong? And how do you kind of figure out in these races where one party really outperforms, even if they don't win, how do you figure out, is it because one party was really weak or the other candidate was really strong?
That's a good question, because sometimes it can be about pundits and not about the actual data, right? Like a media narrative can emerge. I would say part of the difference there is that also Brooks is not an incumbent. So she's in many ways kind of a representative of sort of a generic Democrat. Well, Kathy Hochul as an incumbent, someone with policies and kind of a track record to run on, I think her unpopularity and her approval ratings, which were definitely worse both now and previously, to also Brooks, showed that it was actually partially her weakness. And then I think part of it, of course, is that Zeldin really did run a campaign that resonated with people and resonated with media, that he was able to kind of really connect with voters on crime, on immigration, in a way that connected to people. But it's part of that is that his strategy, I think, was to kind of make or to continue Kathy Hochul's unpopularity. Kind of transitioning from that, I think, and Nancy Pelosi has kind of hinted that in the interviews with her recent book, that she thinks Kathy Hochul's unpopularity actually possibly led to Democrats losing the House in 2022. A number of competitive House seats, both this year and in 2022, are in these deep blue areas. They're in California, or they're in New York City, or the New York City so-called media market for advertising. And Pelosi seemed to imply, and many people think, that Kathy Hochul's weakness was a part of the reason that Dems lost these seats.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And producer Megan Mack confirms it was 5.7 points Kathy Hochul beat Lee Zeldin by in the gubernatorial campaign here. So before we get back to the U.S. Senate, Joseph, what is going to be an interesting set of results, or what would be noteworthy to you about congressional, about House races in New York State, given some of the mess that Democrats made in recent years with House seats in this state? What would be interesting to you here?
Sure. So I have a number of races I'm keeping my eye on. They're in either the kind of Hudson Valley area or around Long Island, as well as one seat around Syracuse. And these are seats primarily that Biden won pretty easily. I think one of them in the kind of Long Island, New York City area around Queens, Biden won by about 13 points in 2020. So we're talking an area that is very willing to support certain Democrats, but then was, of course, had a big swing in 2022 towards Zeldin, towards congressional Republicans. So I'm very interested to see in these areas, and this is also a similar area to the infamous George Santos seat, so kind of similar demographic territory. So I'm curious to see whether Democrats can recover there and in other areas of New York where they really struggled in 2022.
But this was a lot of self-inflicted wounds for Democrats, wasn't it, in this state?
I would say arguably. It's a really fascinating pattern to me that there was this regional divergence. So in many places and seats, including in the state of Ohio, for example, Democrats held on just fine in congressional swing seats in Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, a little less so in Michigan, but in many sort of like traditional swing seats, they did well. And then in these deep blue areas in Oregon and California, New York, They just completely flopped. I think arguably that's a self-inflicted wound that they weren't able to marshal and get their voters together, to often because of low turnout among Democratic and aligned voters.
Talking to Joseph Burgess, a team leader at the Social Sciences Data Lab at the University of Copenhagen, who does a great job of setting me straight or making sure my assumptions are fair and making all of us better data consumers. And we opened with a little bit of talk about the presidential race, but most of this hour we're talking about the races around the country that will determine the balance of power, the Senate races. We'll talk about in our second half hour coming up after this only break here. We're going to talk about more in the U.S. Senate. The Nebraska race really is fascinating, but I think it ties into what Democrats have had to do to build this coalition to try to have a majority in the U.S. Senate when the map, I think in Joseph's word, the map this year is bad, but the Senate map in general does not favor Democrats. And so we'll talk more about that, these individual races. We'll take some questions, comments, if you've got them, as we try to understand where the polls and what the dynamics are as we are, just over a month to Election Day and early voting starting in some places starts here October 26th. So it's 844-295-TALK if you want to call the program. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program, connections@WXXI.org. My guest is Joseph Burgess, team leader at the Social Sciences Data Lab at the University of Copenhagen. We're right back.
From WXXI News, I'm Jasmine Singer. This Friday on Environmental Connections, we'll explore the impact of microplastics on human health, featuring insights on the documentary Plastic People. Then in our second hour, we'll shift our focus to climate activism and arrests, examining how these efforts are driving environmental change. Tune into Environmental Connections this Friday.
This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Tom emails the program to say, you've gone all this time without talking about Mark Robinson? Are you going to talk about Mark Robinson? Trust me, Joseph Burgess is not staying up late in Copenhagen. It's not that late in Copenhagen. I don't think it's that late. But he's not staying up with us to miss a chance to talk about the Mark Robinson story. How late is it over there, Joseph?
You know, it's 7:30, and I'm a sleepy guy, I got to say. But I think I can stay up late enough to finish this conversation if I must. And I'm obsessed with the Mark Robinson story. It does feel like something in American politics is broken and that all of our scandals seem to be getting dumber and funnier and sillier.
Yeah,
and,
they're getting pretty
I guess
dumb.
That's just the way it goes. Yeah, this would not happen in Denmark, by the way, I got to say. But
you don't have Springfield, Ohio. You don't have Springfield, Ohio's and North Carolina governor race type scandals in Denmark?
You know, my Danish isn't that great, so maybe we're having them and no one is telling me about them, but if so, I'd prefer not to know, honestly. I'm fascinated by that. I think it's a good example of what we talked about with the kind of MAGA without Trump, and that this candidate has some kind of Trump-like scandal in the way he talks, especially the things he said, which are a lot of it, honestly, is so indecent, I don't think we can discuss it on the radio.
I was thinking, how am I going to encapsulate this for listeners who haven't followed Mark Robinson? I'm going to do my best here. So Mark Robinson is currently the lieutenant governor of the state of North Carolina. He is running for governor. He is the Republican in that race. The Republican governor, Roy Cooper, not running. And there's a Democrat in the race. The polls had been pretty close. It's a state that is on the swing state category. The latest polls between Trump and Harris show a 49-49 or a 50-49 race, depending on the day. So it's very close on the presidential side. For the Republican candidate for governor, it's gotten, it's become an almost unwinnable race based on the polls now, because in the last couple of weeks it has come out that Mark Robinson, who is a black man who has been critical in the past of Martin Luther King, he has sort of mocked and denied the Holocaust, but Even worse now, somebody did a lot of digging into his online history, and he has been posting in, I'm just going to try to euphemize here, online, very specific niche porn communities, and he has said ghastly things about all kinds of groups, including, he said he would like slavery to come back so he could own slaves. He is a black man. He's described himself as a black Nazi. He has defended Hitler, and he hates Martin Luther King. Even though Donald Trump, before all this came out, Donald Trump came to North Carolina for a rally, introduced Mark Robinson, referred to him as Martin Luther King on steroids, and said that he would be a great governor. I think that might be, Joseph, just because I don't know if Trump is all that familiar with too many other black leaders to compare a current black candidate to, but that's what he said. And now the polls show that Robinson is down double digits. His staff is quitting. He has said he's going to get to the bottom of this. He's denied all of this stuff about the online postings. Although when security firms have offered to help actually do a forensic online scan to figure it out, they said, we could get to the bottom of this. He said, no, you don't have to do that, but I'll get to the bottom of it myself. So his staff is quitting. It looks like he's going to lose. Did I euphemize too much? How did I do there? What do you want to add there, Joseph?
I don't have too much to add. It's an insane story, start to finish, certainly. I do think, again, and now I'm repeating myself now a bit, that's my takeaway, though, is that you can't, not everyone can be Trump. Not everyone can have these sort of frequent scandals and be able to kind of continue past unscathed. In some ways, the kind of normal political ecosystem does exist. And that many of these candidates, if they do these kind of, in this case, like freakish and bizarre statements and scandals, that it does hurt them. And I know sometimes people say, why didn't that affect Trump? And that's always a good question. It's interesting that it is unique to him, right? That these candidates are hurt by these scandals.
That's a subject for someone much smarter than me, because I've wondered that for a long time. But now let me ask you to kind of take the Mark Robinson story and let's expand the question to the kinds of voters who, there will be voters who vote, either don't vote in the gubernatorial race or vote for the Democrat because of how odious Mark Robinson has become, but they will also vote for Trump. There are Ohioans who will vote for Sherrod Brown, and they will vote for Trump. I mean, I don't know that Sherrod Brown, the U.S. senator who's looking for another term, will win. But if he wins, and it's close, the Republican candidate is another Trump-endorsed candidate, Bernie Moreno. They're trying to win this Ohio Senate seat and take it away from a longtime Democratic stalwart. So Sherrod Brown, if he wins, it's going to be close. Let's say he wins by a point. But Ohio is going to be a comfortable Trump win. You know, it could be 7 points, could be nine, could be double digits. Take a look at Montana. Montana was plus 16 for Trump 4 years ago. John Tester, the multi-term Democrat, is running for re-election in a very close Senate race. He, you know, if he wins, it's going to be really tight. If he loses, it'll be close, probably. Either way, it'll be close, but Trump will win easily. So tell me about the voters, Joseph. Tell me a little bit more about voters who would say, I'm for Sherrod Brown in Ohio, but I'm also for Trump. I am for John Tester in Montana, but I'm for Trump. I am for the Democrat in North Carolina, but I will vote for Trump. I mean, help me understand some of that split that is going on.
Sure. And this is a pattern that goes beyond these red states or semi-red states, is that we're actually seeing Democratic Senate candidates do very well in almost all of their targeted races. So Nevada, Pennsylvania, even Wisconsin to some degree. So all these Arizona, definitely. So all these classic swing states that everyone is focused on for the presidential, you'll see a poll that has maybe, you know, Harris or Trump slightly leading or tied, and then the Democratic candidate doing quite well. So it's worth thinking of that pattern, those swing states, when you look at Montana and Ohio. And that I think it's kind of the same pattern where, and it's something I think I'm not quite sure, to be honest with you. I can paint you a picture of these voters, but I'd almost love to be having this conversation the day after the election, so we have a better idea of how real these voters are, right? Like, why is it that the Democratic candidates for Senate aren't really overperforming Harris so much? I have some ideas. I would guess that these candidates are very strongly pro-choice, for one. They're Trump supportive. Mm-hmm. They're often maybe lower collar, unlikely to be college educated, white voters, possibly male. So I would say that's a large population of these voters. But it's hard to say for sure.
I would love to, the day after the election, to talk to that section of Ohio voters who were voted for Trump and Sherrod Brown. That is just so interesting to me. And, you know, ultimately, it's not a huge part of the population, but it is enough to maybe swing elections. The John Tester, Donald Trump voters. I mean, it's very interesting to me. Can I ask you about Nebraska a little bit more? Nebraska is, of course, a red state, if you want to categorize it by color. Trump's going to win it easily. And it's got an incumbent Republican in the U.S. Senate, Deb Fischer, who's running for re-election. And her main opponent is not a Democrat. Her opponent is an independent, Dan Osborne, who, according to the New York Times, led a strike at the Kellogg's plant in Omaha in 2021 and is trying to test out whether a pro-labor working-class message can resonate as an independent candidate. Now, in the U.S. Senate, which has been this, you know, 50-50 split, with Dems having Vice President Harris as the tie-breaking vote, the Dems have had to put a coalition together because the U.S. Senate map does not favor the Democratic Party right now. That's just the reality of it. You have, Joseph will tell it better than I can, but, you know, California's got 39 million people and two senators, and then, you know, you can combine something like, you know, 17 states' population to get California's, and they have 34 senators combined to two. So it doesn't favor Democrats. They've had to pull together this coalition of some independents, some Democrats, some moderate, some further left. What is the story in Nebraska, and how does it line up? And then let's talk more broadly about how Democrats are dealing with just sort of the situation with the Senate at this point.
Well, I think it's all one story where the Democratic Party, I think the Democratic Senate main campaign finance arm, actually announced major investments in woke Florida and Texas today. They're looking to expand the map, and not because of some great success with the current situation, but because of the essentially trouble they're in, that they Montana is looking not great for them at the moment to see if they would like to hold. They're like 100% likely to lose West Virginia. Ohio is very competitive. So they're looking to expand this map. And then Nebraska is just sort of its own interesting story, where this one Republican senator with very few scandals, as far as I know, I can't think of anything major to discuss on air, has always had fairly low approval ratings. So a independent is giving it a shot. I think for the reasons we've discussed, it's quite unlikely that he'll be successful. It could be potentially something where he runs and then maybe runs for governor later down the line. But independent bids like this are very difficult, for one. But also, again, it's just difficult to escape at the end of the day, the partisan gravity where someone goes into the booth and they vote for Donald Trump, who is going to win Nebraska. And then they just start, you know, going down the line and they're like, all right, well, I'll vote for Deb Fischer, the Republican again. Maybe they're not even super enthusiastic about it, but they're not making, you know, they're not investing that much thought or philosophy into that decision. Most voters at the end of the day will just be like, all right, I guess I'll vote for all the Republicans. Sure.
Well, that'll be an interesting one to watch. Now, you mentioned Texas and Florida with the Democratic National Committee investing more money trying to win those Senate seats. And in Texas, it's Ted Cruz, the longtime incumbent, running for re-election against Colin Allred, who is the Democrat. In Florida, Rick Scott running for re-election. And, you know, that's a member of Congress, Debbie McCarthy Powell, who is running against Scott. You look at those states, and here's what I think sometimes people don't often remember, or maybe just the recent reality of politics has not fully set in yet. I grew up in Ohio, which was a swing state. It was a purple state. And, you know, bounces back and forth for a long time before it has solidified in the Trump era as a red state. In Texas, longtime red state, I don't know that it's purple yet, but the margin that Donald Trump won Ohio was significantly more than his margin in Texas. He won Ohio by more than 8 points. He won Texas by 5. He won Florida by 3.5 points. And Florida has, you know, under Ron DeSantis, who's done wonderfully well for Republicans there, they've won a lot of, they've done very well at the state level. DeSantis has had won a dominant reelection. We sort of think of Florida as out of play for Democrats, but it's not, was not a huge margin 4 years ago. So you've got this idea that Democrats have that, okay, Ohio's out of reach, but Texas and Florida might not be. Is that the right mindset? I mean, do you look at those races in Texas and Florida and think they realistically, and I'm, by the way, I'm not talking about Sherrod Brown. I'm talking about in the presidential race. But in general, when you look at Texas and Florida, does it make sense for them to pour more resources into those races?
You know, it absolutely makes sense for them to pour resources in there. And there's one major reason for that. They have a lot of money. They really do. It's that simple at the end of the day. So especially when the presumptive nominee switched from Biden to Kamala Harris, Democrats started, you know, it's the, if you've ever watched DuckTales, it's the Scrooge McDuck scene where he jumps in the water tower of money.
The pile of money, yes.
The pile of money. So that's their current financial situation. So from that perspective alone, there's very little danger in them doing that. They're not going to run out of cash, even investing in these very large and expensive states to do advertising in, simply because they have that much money that it's worth it to do. So from that perspective, it is. And then those specific states, I think it's worth thinking about Rick Scott, the incumbent Republican senator specifically. So in his last three races, for governor twice, and then for Senate, he's won very narrowly every single time. So Democrats have had a very unlucky run in Florida recently where, you know, any tight race they've lost. But it doesn't, you know, 3.4 or whatever Trump won by is not insurmountable. And certainly Dems will continue to look to compete in one of the largest states in the country. Texas, of course, I think we could continue to see going to the left in a way that Dems want to compete for governor, for Senate, and eventually for president.
Does it make sense to you that in the next 20 years we'll see Texas vote for a Democrat for president before we will see Florida and Ohio do it again?
That's a really interestingly phrased question. It depends a lot on where the Hispanic vote goes, and that could be a whole other episode of Connections, so I don't want to spend too much time on it. But I would say maybe, which is not super helpful. It's something I think about a lot, is especially the kind of Texas Hispanic vote along the border, the Cuban vote in Florida. I feel like we're kind of in the middle maybe of figuring out sort of the next 20 years of the Hispanic vote and the Hispanic and Latino vote. And I'm not quite sure where that's going to go.
Yeah, I try not to, let me put it this way. I try not to make Joseph make predictions because no smart data analyst likes that. I'm more interested in where trend lines are moving. And we learned a pretty good lesson on this program over multiple conversations in the last decade with panelists who come from the Hispanic Latino community. And the first thing they'll tell you is we're not a monolith. Don't talk about us like we're a monolith. Cubans in Florida tend to be pretty conservative. And the Hispanic vote in general, if you do want to talk about it monolithically, is becoming a little bit more conservative over time. So there's no easy, perfect way to say, well, in 20 years, it's going to be doing this or that. It's just interesting being back in Ohio where I grew up now. And it's not a swing state right now. It's very interesting to see that move. Let me read an email from Dell, who's listening, who wants to challenge this idea that Donald Trump is a sort of a uniquely strong candidate. He says, I feel like Trump's strong candidate status in the presidential race has a lot more to do with the GOP bias in the Electoral College than anything else. In most other races, a MAGA Trump-esque candidate is not likely to serve them well, except in deep red districts with a strong MAGA base. So I've been thinking about that kind of point. I want to hear what Joseph thinks about this, because I heard somebody recently compare Trump, say that if Trump loses this year, that he's in the William Jennings Bryan category. And I don't think that that makes a ton of sense, because William Jennings Bryan never won anything. He didn't win a popular vote. He didn't win an electoral vote. He was a multi-losing candidate who sort of earned that reputation. Trump won the presidency. He's never won the popular vote. He's likely to be a three-time loser in the popular vote. So I don't think he's going to be in the William Jennings Bryan category. But part of what Dell is saying, Joseph, is he's not as strong as sometimes he is portrayed to be. The candidates he has anointed don't do well. He didn't do well in his own midterms. He has a lot of losing on that record, and that it's the Electoral College situation that props him up. I want to hear your take on this.
I think it's always a good point to discuss how the Electoral College is currently systematically propping up the Republican Party and their potential ability to win the presidency. So I'm glad this listener did that. But I guess I would sort of agree with it, but reframe it slightly, which is that, you know, if your strength is as a politician, that you reached out to the voters you needed, in this case, to get an Electoral College advantage, I would say you're a strong politician, and he certainly did that, right? So the voters that he won over from the Democratic Party who swung to him were in locations that were very helpful to him and to the Republican Party. So I would agree, but I guess I would reframe it slightly.
What do you think is at stake for, again, I don't want to move in the realm of prediction. I guess what I'm curious to know is if it is a best case scenario for the Democrats, and maybe the best case scenario, clearly their best case involves winning the presidency in November. Probably the best case scenario means holding the U.S. Senate. I mean, I think that would be a pretty big upset just based on all of the races that are available for Republicans to pick off. But if it's a best case scenario night for Democrats, can you imagine what is the right sort of strategic move if you were, you know, if you're sitting in the room of Republican strategists who are trying to figure out what to do next here after November defeats? Is it a, hey, MAGA is, it's going to be the flavor going forward here, and we just got to find the next person at the top of it? Or it's, no, Trump is sui generis, and it's not something we can repeat, and you know, let's learn that lesson. I wonder what those conversations would be like, Joseph.
Sure, and I will give you my prediction also. Why not? I think it's kind of fun too. But to quickly answer the actual question, I almost think it's not worth asking. In that, for example, after the 2012 presidential race, the Republican Party released a strategic document saying they had to moderate on immigration in order to win the presidency. And then they nominated Donald Trump and won the presidency. So I'm less interested in kind of the sort of strategic angle on it, in that I think Donald Trump or someone like him will continue to be such a dominating force in Republican Party politics and primaries that I don't think it's worth thinking about like some sort of smoke-filled backroom, right? I just don't think that's as realistic as the kind of MAGA wing of the party continuing to win primaries all over. That being said, I think my prediction would be, I think Democrats are likely to lose the Senate. I think that's kind of the most likely outcome. I do think it's very possible they pick up the House. If I had to bet on it, that's what I would say. And the presidency, I could flip a coin. So good luck, America.
He says from Denmark. All right, before we let you go, we didn't even get to mention some of these other toss-up states or really close Senate election states, Michigan being one of them. You know, I'm not sure. I mean, I would think that Casey in Pennsylvania, who is a well-known quantity, is in good position. Baldwin in Wisconsin, well-known quantity in I would think, good position. But certainly the Michigan open seat is one that's important. Any closing thoughts from you about these races that are not presidential races that we should be keyed in on?
Sure. I think the Michigan one is interesting because it's a more establishment aligned Republican versus a non-incumbent Democrat, so not a longtime well-known figure. So I do expect that could be closer than some of the other Senate races with very strong incumbent Democratic candidates. I think it's going to be a really interesting night, and I think it's going to be a very long one.
I'm going to try to squeeze this in the last 40 seconds. Eric Adams is having a news conference right now. It's, according to social media, not going well. Andrew Cuomo's close associates say that he really wants to run for New York City mayor. That's a New York City story, but does that story have any national implications? What are you watching there? About 40 seconds.
I am watching the House races in the New York City media market. I want to see if the Democratic candidates, how they react, what they say about corruption, about politics, because I think these New York City and adjacent areas might decide control of the House of Representatives.
Very interesting. And I know it'll be very interesting if Andrew Cuomo gets back into politics. I'm not sure. Well, I mean, his team thinks that that's what the people want. We'll see. Joseph Burgess, team leader at the Social Sciences Data Lab at the University of Copenhagen. You have really rolled with our schedule this week. You've been very generous with your time. You always are. And I hope we can talk to you again. I hope before the election, but regardless, sometime soon, to make us all smarter. Thank you, Joseph.
Thanks, Evan.
Great having him as always. Listeners, thanks for hanging in there with us. And really outstanding work from the team today. Too long a list to mention. Well, I should mention, of course, Rob Braden, Julie Williams, and Mike Black, and probably many more that I'm not even thinking of. Producer Megan Mack and myself bringing you connections. From the road a little bit today, broadcasting from the state of Ohio, but happy to be with you during Pledge Week. I hope you're a member of your public radio. Have a great day. Talk to you tomorrow.